Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, LRIS's monthly podcast about recent developments in public safety labor relations. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for this month's podcast. I'm guessing we're going to run a little bit long because there's a lot of stuff that has been happening and will be happening that we need to cover. And let me start with the big one. The Supreme Court has accepted for hearing, for review, the case of Janus versus AFSCME. This is a case out of Chicago, actually out of Illinois, and the case tees up what has been one of the central questions in labor relations for the last 4 or 5 years. Is fair share constitutional? So let me set the stage for you here, because we've got a lot of things weaving together that bring us to this development. And first of all, let's start with a definition of terms. What's fair share? What's not fair share? So think of collective bargaining laws in this country as having basically two structures, public employee collective bargaining laws, that is, two structures in terms of union membership. One structure is what's known as an open shop. The second structure is what's known as an agency shop. Let's take those one at a time. An open shop is a collective bargaining law that says that someone who is in a bargaining unit can either be a member or not be a member of the labor organization. And if they choose not to be a member, they don't have to pay anything to the labor organization. In almost every state where there are open shops, and they've now been rebranded, by the way, as right-to-work environments, sort of a successful national rebranding effort by some Washington, D.C. area think tanks. In open shops, most states have laws that still require unions to observe a duty of fair representation with respect to non-members. And that means that someone can choose not to be a member of a labor organization and doesn't have to pay anything to the labor organization, but can still demand services from the labor organization. And in fact, the union can't treat that individual any differently than it would a full member because that individual is not paying any dues. This is what unions characterize as the free rider problem, where they have members of their bargaining unit who choose not to be members of the union, who say, I'm not going to pay you anything. And yet, when it comes time for that individual to enjoy the benefits of the collective bargaining agreement, that individual can demand that they get the same benefits as everybody else. When that individual gets into trouble in a disciplinary sense, that member can look to the union for representation, and the union can't say, no, we're not going to represent you because you don't pay anything. That's the essence of an open shop. That's the essence of a right-to-work environment. Now, the other type of union membership, which I refer to as an agency shop, still allows members of the bargaining unit to not be members of the labor organization, but also allows the employer and the union the ability to negotiate a clause in the collective bargaining agreement that says, if you exercise your right not to be a member, you must still pay to the union your fair share of the costs of negotiating and administering the contract. These have become known as fair share states. And that's the vast majority of states that have collective bargaining for public safety employees. Those are fair share states. Fair share dues are less than regular union dues. They can't include, for example, political contributions. They can't include any charges for anything that's unrelated to the negotiation and administration of the collective bargaining agreement. So, for example, police and fire unions do a lot of stuff that isn't related to the collective bargaining process. Very frequently, for example, they'll have Christmas parties. That's not related to the collective bargaining process. On other occasions, they will make donations to charitable organizations, Toys for Tots, for example. That's not related to the collective bargaining process. They may hold an annual picnic. They may send flowers to employees who are in the hospital or who have suffered a loss in their family. None of those sorts of things are related to the collective bargaining process. Hence, fair share members can't be charged for those things. And so you tend to see fair share dues somewhere around 80 to 90% of union dues. And they must be, in the parlance of the courts, they must be four things that are related to the negotiation and administration of the contract. Well, early on, when we started seeing statewide collective bargaining statutes, so in the 1960s, 1970s, very quickly, we had challenges from employees who didn't want to be members, didn't want to pay anything to a union. We had challenges, and the challenges were launched on a constitutional basis. And the most important of those challenges can be phrased something like this. Look, even though you have excluded political contributions and formal political activity from fair share assessments, even though I don't have to pay anything for that, the very act of negotiating a collective bargaining agreement in the public sector is in and of itself political in nature. And under the free speech guarantees of the First Amendment, you, the government that's passing the collective bargaining law, you, the government, can't force me to engage in speech. Therefore, fair share is unconstitutional. It violates my First Amendment rights. And eventually, that challenge made it to the U.S. Supreme Court. 40 years ago, it made it to the U.S. Supreme Court in the form of a case that came out of the city of Detroit. It's known as the Abood case, Abood versus City of Detroit, or vice versa. Sometimes I get the names mixed up in the order. And in Abood, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of fair share. The court looked at the objectors, looked at the non-members, and said, you know what? You're right. There is an extent to which negotiating a collective bargaining agreement is in and of itself political speech. And you know what? You're right. The general rule under the First Amendment is that the government can't force individuals to engage in speech. But here there's an overriding issue, an overriding governmental concern that leads us to conclude that fair share is constitutional. And what's that overriding concern? The overriding concern is the free rider problem, the notion that you can have these people in the bargaining unit who can demand that the union spend money on their behalf without ever paying a cent to the union. That, says the Supreme Court, has at least the potential, if not the reality, to cause labor unrest, and it is an overriding government interest to prevent that unrest. Well, for many years, this was just simply settled law. No one really challenged fair share, and because, after all, we have a Supreme Court decision that's right on point, and the Supreme Court very typically will follow its precedent. We started to see cracks in the armor, though, boy, I want to say about 15 years ago. And we started to see it because of a confluence of two things that were going on. The first thing that was going on is you started to have a bunch of very politically conservative think tanks get focused on the issue of fair share, most notably one out of Virginia that's known as the Right to Work Foundation. And they ended up supporting, bankrolling, challenges to fair share all across the country. Most often those challenges were what should be included in the fair share assessment versus what should be excluded. But increasingly they started focusing on challenging the very existence of fair share. The second development that occurred is that we started to see a change in the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court began to be very unfriendly for labor. By my count, over the last 15 years or so, and my count's totally unofficial, and somebody else counting could come up with different numbers. But if you look at all the labor relations cases coming out of the Supreme Court in the last 15 years, unions have won less than 10% of those cases. And a record of 90-10, or I think the number's actually a little bit higher, that's not at all an accident, right? That's an ideology coming out of the Supreme Court. It's a pro-employer, anti-union ideology. And many of these cases were decided by a 5-4 vote of the members of the Supreme Court with the same five justices in the majority. And it's probably not going to surprise anybody at all that many of those cases, that 5-4 majority was made up of the five members of the court appointed by Republican presidents. And the four dissenting justices were those appointed by Democratic presidents. And as the years progressed, and I know I'm giving you quite a bit of a history story here, but I think it's important to understand the history to know where we are today. As the years progressed, those five justices, all five of them, began to drop hints in their opinions, sometimes in footnotes, sometimes in concurring or dissenting opinions, that they thought that Abood versus City of Detroit was wrongly decided, that really fair share should be unconstitutional. They never really got around to taking up the perfect case on that until finally they took a case in 2015 that was heard by the court for oral argument in January 2016. And it was a case that came out of California. It's known as the Friedrichs case. It's a teacher's case. And it teed up squarely the question of whether or not Abood should be overturned. Now, one of the other things you need to know about this Supreme Court that we've had for the last 15 years or so is it is the most activist Supreme Court in the history of the country. And by activist, I don't mean conservative or liberal. I mean activist in the sense of a willingness to find statutes unconstitutional based upon the court's own formulation of what constitutional rights are. And by activist, I also mean a willingness to overturn established precedent. So, for example, where the court 20 years ago were it faced with the same fair share situation where it had a decision of 40 years standing, would have thought twice and three times and four times and probably never have fought to overturn a 40-year-old precedent, our current Supreme Court really thinks very little about precedent and overturning decisions that can be 20, 30, or 40 years old. So when the Friedrichs case was orally argued, it really wasn't a surprise to many people to find four of those five justices who've been in the majority in these employment cases, four of them saying things from the bench during oral argument that indicated that Friedrichs wasn't just on life support, Abood was not just on life support, but that Friedrichs was going to end the situation once and for all. What about that fifth justice? That's Justice Thomas. He didn't say anything in the oral argument. That's not a surprise. He never does, or very rarely does. I think at the time, he hadn't said anything in oral argument in 10 years in any case. He just simply doesn't believe in commenting in oral argument or asking questions. He thinks that should be up to the lawyers. But everybody knew how he was going to vote on the Friedrichs case. So we left the oral argument in January 2016 thinking, no more fair share. And then the following month, one of the other justices in that 5-4 majority, Justice Scalia, died. And that meant when it came time for the court to vote on the fair share case on Friedrichs, it split by a 4-4 margin. And what happens when the Supreme Court has a 4-4 tie on what to do with the decision? What happens is that the lower court's opinion is upheld, and there's no opinion that comes from the Supreme Court. And that's exactly what happened in Friedrichs. And what was the lower court's opinion? The lower court's opinion said, hey, Abood versus City of Detroit, still good law. Fair share is constitutional. And unions exhaled. They breathed a sigh of relief. And then, of course, we saw what happened in the search for the replacement of Justice Scalia. We saw Mitch McConnell simply not allow a committee hearing to occur on President Obama's proposed replacement. That nomination expired with the term of President Obama. And one of the first things that President Trump did was to select for that seat Justice Stephen Gorsuch. And where did President Trump come up with Justice Gorsuch's name? Came up with it from a list of 14 or 15, I forget what it is, names of lower court judges that was recommended by a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C., one of these same think tanks that has been advocating the end to fair share. So how is Justice Gorsuch likely to vote in this Janus case, which once again does what Friedrichs did, tee up squarely the question of whether fair share is constitutional in this country? How will he likely vote? Well, let me give you a hint. First of all, I'll give you several hints. Employers were thrilled with the nomination of Justice Gorsuch. I try to read all of the national labor blogs that are published by either employer side law firms or union side law firms. By the way, I heartily recommend that you do that. They're all free, and it's a great way of staying up to date on what the law is or what the law may become. Well, when Justice Gorsuch was nominated, employer side blogs just exploded with praise for the nomination. And there's one employer side blog that I remember very well saying that Justice Gorsuch would be the intellectual heir to Justice Scalia. So that's one hint as to how he might vote. Second hint is we've seen a few opinions from him. No labor opinions yet, but we've seen other opinions, and they indicate that if anything, that prediction that Justice Gorsuch would be the intellectual heir to Antonin Scalia, if anything, that was modest, because he appears to be far more conservative than Antonin Scalia on several issues. And the third hint that you have is, you may have seen this, but Justice Gorsuch is in some hot water. There's lots of criticism about him because he's accepting speaking paid speaking gigs, apparently. The finances are a little murky, but they appear to be paid speaking gigs at these far-right think tanks. And one of them, for which he's getting the most criticism, is that he will be speaking in a couple of months at the Federalist Society. Now, the Federalist Society, like the Right to Work Foundation, it's not going to surprise you at all to know that one or both of the Koch brothers and or their foundations are contributors. That's the sort of organization this is. The Federalist Society was first of all, Justice Gorsuch appears to be a member of it and was a strong supporter of him in his nomination for the Supreme Court. If you go to their webpage, you will find fair share described as union tyranny. So that's a third hint as to how this case is going to come out. Bottom line, I think you'd be foolish if you didn't think that when the Janus case is decided, we're going to see the end of fair share in public sector in this country. The whole country, in one fell swoop, will be turned into a right-to-work country. And that's going to have profound effects on both the public and private sector union movement in this country. It's been in the public sector that unions have had their greatest strength in the last 20 years. Now, if you have this situation where there's no more fair share, I'm not so sure police and fire unions are really going to lose many members. They'll lose a few. I don't think they're going to lose many members, though. Corrections unions, I think, are going to lose more. They tend to be more riven with discord than police or fire unions. But you know where who's really going to get hurt? It's the AFSCMEs and the Service Employees International Unions of the world. It's the teachers' unions of the world, where you have had many of these fights over fair share over the years. And that is going to actually resound to the detriment of public safety unions. Why? Because when you have these attacks on collective bargaining, and make no mistake about it, we're in the middle of a national attack on collective bargaining right now. When you have these attacks on collective bargaining, who provides the funding, the vast majority of the funding, to fight off, for example, Ohio revising its collective bargaining law to pretty much end collective bargaining? Who provides that funding? It's the AFSCMEs and teachers' unions of the world. And so as they get hurt by the end of fair share, public safety employees are going to get hurt. There's just no question about that. So what are unions talking about as to how to respond to this situation? Well, some of them, of course, haven't given up. Some of them think that the Supreme Court is going to have, and I've got to be a little bit sarcastic here, a massive brain transplant, and that by the time we get the decision in Janus, which will come by the end of June 2018, the Supreme Court will say, oh, you know what, we do think we should be following 40-year-old precedent, and we do recognize the free rider problem as a significant problem, and will not overturn fair share. I think that's very foolish to think that. I think we've got a pretty clear 5-4 vote to end fair share. So beyond just simply, as Dusty Springfield once sang, wishing and hoping, what are unions doing? Second thing they're doing is they are sticking their head in the sand. They are saying, you know what we ought to do? We need to focus on internal organizing. And we need to show everybody, all of our potential non-members, what benefits we bring. When I say sticking their heads in the sand, I just don't see that as being very profitable. I don't think that's going to produce much in the way of results. The third thing that unions are doing that I do think has a chance of influencing people is they're taking what I think of as a carrot and stick approach to the whole issue of the loss of fair share. And let's talk about the stick first. I think there are some unions that are thinking about going to their state legislatures, or if you bargain under a local ordinance, going to your county board of commissioners or city council and saying, hey, if we can't get fair share payments from them, we want you to amend the duty of fair representation so we don't have to represent them. Because why should we have to pay our money, the union's money, to represent people who aren't our members, who pay us nothing? And I think that's actually a pretty convincing argument, no matter what political stripe you are. Why should any private organization, and that's what a union is, have to spend its own money to provide representation to someone who's not a member of that organization? So I think that's actually has some potentially interested legislators. Also, on the same stick approach, I think there's a legal argument to be made out here. I know some unions are examining this, saying that if you do not have fair share anymore, the duty of fair representation cannot constitutionally compel unions to provide representation to non-members. To do so, is an improper taking under the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. Well, you know the Fifth Amendment for a lot of different things, right? The Founding Fathers packed a wallop into the Fifth Amendment. We know it as the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. We also know it as the Self-Incrimination Clause of the Constitution. But there's also a provision in the Fifth Amendment that says that government may not take property without proper compensation. And as the argument would go, and I like it, I think it actually makes a lot of sense, you can't have a duty of fair representation that forces unions without compensation to expend their own resources. That is a taking. So that's the two aspects of the stick part of the carrot and stick. What are unions thinking about with respect to the carrot, at least those unions that are thinking about this? They're thinking about member-only benefits, even if the duty of fair representation still exists with respect to non-members. They're thinking, why don't we offer benefits that we're not obliged to provide under the duty of fair representation, but they'll be for members only. And because it's not within the scope of the duty of fair representation, we can only offer those benefits to union members. We won't be violating anybody's rights by saying, non-members, you don't get these benefits. And that, by the way, I think very clearly is the law. So what type of benefits are we talking about? Police have had an edge on this forever and ever. Because with police, they offer legal defense plans. And a portion of those legal defense plans deals with things that are within the duty of fair representation, the portion of them that deals with administrative defense, providing attorneys or whatever or other representatives when a police officer is being investigated for disciplinary purposes. But a portion of them has nothing whatsoever to do with the duty of fair representation, and that's providing an attorney in criminal situations, particularly when officers are involved in the use of deadly force. And most of those legal defense plans also provide an attorney when the officer is sued arising out of the job. Neither of those would likely be within the scope of the duty of fair representation. So police unions have these legal defense plans out there, and I think you can expect to see those police unions just simply figuratively crossing their arms and saying, okay, no more legal defense plan, or at least the criminal and civil aspect of a legal defense plan, no more legal defense plan unless you're a full member of the labor organization. There's other things that can be on the carrot side of the equation as well. Unions could offer and do offer, like long-term disability insurance that's not offered through the employer. They can offer discounted rates for goods and services. I know of some union web pages where there's a sub-web page that is chock full of things that you can only get if you're a union member, a cruise in the Caribbean or, you know, whatever it might be. So unions are looking at this carrot and stick approach as an answer to the loss of fair share. But whatever is going on out there in the development of strategy on this, I think everybody needs to accept as a realistic possibility, a probability, that come June 2018, fair share will be no more. We will be, for public sector purposes, a right-to-work country. And that's going to bring about a fundamental change in labor relations in this country. Well, that was cheery, wasn't it? any rate, let me move on to something that I think has less significance, but it's still something I think everybody needs to know. And this just totally took me by surprise, and I realized looking into it, it's actually been out there, or hints of it have been out there for a couple of years, and I don't know why it shocked me. You know, the Consumer Price Index is being basically reconfigured by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and that it's going to happen in 2018? Yeah, it will. We'll put the links on our webpage for you, so you can go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics webpage and see how the reconfiguration is going to happen. I need to warn you. You know how Google now has the ability to translate web pages on the fly? So if you're looking, for example, for train reservations in Italy, it'll change the Italian web page into an English one. You know how Google can do that? It really needs to develop a English language translator for Bureau of Labor Statistics web pages. These pages are dense. So be prepared once you get there. I can give you the 35,000-foot view of this, but I'll tell you, you need a pro from Dover to really understand it. Here's what you basically need to know, is that come January 1, 2018, the Bureau of Labor Statistics is going to add some CPIs, and it's going to get rid of some CPIs. Well, first of all, the ones that I think are most impacted are the ones the Bureau of Labor Statistics is going to get rid of. It's going to get rid of the indices for Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Milwaukee, Portland, and Kansas City. It's simply not going to publish those indexes anymore. Okay, what's it going to add? It is going to add some new geographic areas, larger geographic areas. I don't know if you recall, but in the past, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has published four regional indices, the Northeast, the Midwest, the South, and the West. It is going to expand those four indices to having nine different indices. So the Northeast index is going to be divided into New England and Middle Atlantic, and the West index into Mountain and Pacific. I don't really need to get into all of that sort of stuff. Just suffice it to say that we're going to see a whole bunch of new regional indices. Also, the cities that are studied in the indexes that are going to be continued, as well as these new ones, are going to be slightly changed. The Bureau of Labor Statistics is going to use different population thresholds for the cities that are included within these, what used to be, for example, the West Index. And so what a comparison that you would draw in 2019 back to 2016 is not going to be completely an apples-to-apples comparison. The national indices, the CPIU, CPIW for all cities, those won't be changed. It's these regional and local indices that are going to be changed. So why do we care about that, particularly when the CPI seems to be hovering in the range of about 1.8 to 2.0%? By the way, predictions are that that seems to be about to increase. The Fed seems to be ready to increase what it calls the discount rate, which is basically the index or the interest rate that large borrowers have to pay. It seems like we might be looking at a little bit, not a lot, a little bit of a run-up of inflation. But we're still talking about low numbers, right? 1.8 to 2.0%. Why do we care about all that? The reason we care about it is that many of you have collective bargaining agreements that have wage escalators that are tied to these old indices. Either the ones that are going to go away, Portland, for example, to take in one index that really hits home for me, or ones that are going to change in terms of their design. So like the West Index, what do you do if you've got this wage escalator that is based on an index that either no longer exists or changes? And the answer is look to your collective bargaining agreement or your memorandum of understanding, because there may be a clause in there that's known as a savings clause that says that if, for whatever reason, some clause in the collective bargaining agreement is no longer enforceable, it'll be the obligation of the parties to renegotiate that clause and provide a substitute that typically maintains the benefit of the bargain. And that's the usual solution. What if you don't have a savings clause? I think then you're going to have to try to agree with the other side, the employer or the union, depending on what side you're on, to voluntarily reopen the contract to deal with some sort of, how do you adjust wages for 2018, 2019, when you don't have your index anymore, as is the case, as I mentioned, in Portland. That one really bugs me that they did that. So, at any rate, look at your contract, see what cost of living measure you have used. Take a look at these couple of web pages that we're posting links for. See if you've got a problem. If you've got a problem, better start talking about it right now, because we're in budget season for January 1 fiscal years, and everybody's going to need to know what these numbers are. All right, now let's turn to arbitration, the world of arbitration, and what I think of as a pretty important arbitrator's decision out of Texas dealing with employer policies and what needs to be in employer policies and what doesn't. So this is a case that comes out of the Austin, Texas Police Department. And what happened in Austin was that in February of 2016, there was a very controversial shooting. The officer who was involved was Jeffrey Freeman. It became one of those uses of deadly force that became front page news for a long, long time. Well, Freeman was friends with Officer Jason Chiappardi. And Chiappardi is going to be the protagonist in this story that I'm about to tell. And a month later, in March of 2016, Chiappardi began posting a series of social media statements using pseudonyms. And you probably know that's usually not going to be a very good strategy, okay? One of Chiappardi's posts read, "My family and friends are glad to hear that the high school dropout, drug-using, neighborhood-terrorizing, naked guy will never scare anybody again." Another post said, and I'm going to read these to you because I think the language of these posts is pretty important. Another post said, "I emailed the boss in support of Jeffrey Freeman. I made it clear that a firing was not necessary and would be a major blow to the department. The boss replied saying Jeff was lucky to have the support of friends like me. It's too fucking bad that the boss has no support for his officers. I hope he leaves soon. He better not ask me how my daughter or family are, since I know it doesn't really matter if another political group gets his attention. As a union rep, I will support Jeff forever. I just watched the video of the press conference, very telling that the boss is feeling for the dropout's family, but makes no mention of Jeff's family." Only one more post that I want to read to you. It becomes apparent to Chiappardi that the department has begun an investigation into his posts, and in response to that, he makes this post. "A couple of days ago, I made a statement in support of my good friend. I'm saddened by the fact that someone had to be childish and tattletaled on me. It's a shame that whoever did it doesn't have a pair. Time to grow up. Guess someone never learned that bringing an apple to teacher doesn't always work." So how does the department find out about this? Well, Chiappardi's list of Facebook friends numbered in excess of 800. His Facebook page and his Twitter account identified him by his full name, did not identify him by his full name, didn't have his photograph, and didn't say anything about the fact that he was an Austin police officer. Nonetheless, one of his friends knew who he was and reported him to the department. The department eventually suspends Chepardi for 3 days, and it cites as the support its employee speech policy. Now listen to this policy, because I'm betting many of you who are listening to this podcast have this same policy. This policy prohibits, and I'm quoting here, speech or expression that, while not made pursuant to an official duty, is significantly linked to or related to the Austin Police Department and tends to compromise or damage the mission, function, reputation, or professionalism of the Austin Police Department or its employees. Okay, so that's the policy. It's a very common policy. You see that sort of language all over the place, particularly that tends to language that doesn't require that the employer actually be hurt, right? It doesn't say that the speech compromises or damages the mission, function, reputation, or professionalism. Instead says tends to compromise or damage the mission, function, reputation, or professionalism. Also, this policy, if you think about that language, doesn't distinguish between speech protected by the First Amendment and speech not protected by the First Amendment. So, for example, you could have a police officer off duty who makes speech that actually, in the judgment of the department, would damage, tend to compromise or damage the department. That would be perfectly legitimate speech, either because it was whistleblowing speech or because it was about a matter of public importance concerning the department, staffing ratios, for example. So the policy is a very, very broad one in terms of allowing the employer to regulate the off-duty speech by employees. So this suspension, 3-day suspension, goes to arbitration, and the arbitrator, in a very, very blunt opinion, overturns the suspension. And he overturns it because he finds the policy unenforceable. He says it is too vague to adequately apprise employees of what the department's expectations are with respect to speech. Now I'm going to read you a few sentences. I know I'm reading you a lot about this opinion, but I think it's really important. A few sentences from the arbitrator's opinion as to why he thinks this policy is a problem and what the source of the policy was. So here's the arbitrator. The city points out that its policy is not just made up locally out of whole cloth, but rather is from the Lexapol created standardized policy manual. I assume most everybody listening to this podcast knows what Lexapol is. It's a private organization out of California that one of the things that it does is to create standardized policies that are put out there, and they are pointed to sometimes as best practices. By the way, a sure way to get my dander up is to label something as a best practice. I know I'm off on a bit of a rant here, but really, all somebody has to say is that this is a best practice, and all of a sudden, it becomes a best practice. When did we stop doing any sort of quantitative or qualitative analysis of a practice to determine whether it was a best practice? When did we simply require the Greek chorus to say enough times, this is a best practice, to make something a best practice? Okay, rant's over. Let's go back to the arbitrator's opinion. He says, in fact, the policy seems to be pulled virtually verbatim from Lexapol policy 1030.4. The obvious implication from the city is that the policy carries an imprimatur of validity because it was created by Lexapol. So, what about Lexapol? And is such validity warranted? Now, here's where the arbitrator veers off into kind of critical language that you pretty rarely see in arbitrators' opinions. Arbitrators tend to be conservative. They don't want to rile up one side or another, or that side's not going to pick them as an arbitrator in the future. Okay, well, get ready. Here's the arbitrator. Setting aside for a moment that Lexapol's employees only give the company a 2.6 out of 5 stars rating as a place of employment, with comments ranging between great company to work for and company has a toxic environment, the arbitrator notes that no court case has been found where Lexapol was even mentioned, much less judged according to its policy manual. In fact, the Pasadena Independent newspaper did an in-depth analysis, and the arbitrator puts in an aside, read hatchet job, of the for-profit company and the reliability of its manual vis-a-vis constitutionality and its real mission. So even though many police departments pay money for the use of Lexapol's policy guidance, the fact that the city of Austin did so in promulgating its policy gives no weight to the policy's ability to survive the just cause test. The arbitrator then says, all right, so looking at the policy, do I understand it? Do I understand what's prohibited and what's permitted in speech? No, I don't. Because I don't think an employee could possibly understand it. But more importantly, it seems very clear the city police department doesn't understand its own policy. The arbitrator points to the police monitor. Her name is Margot Frazier, and she was quoted in a local paper as saying that she has noticed a significant inconsistency under the policy in terms of what gets you in trouble and what doesn't. And she recommended publicly that the police chief either tighten up the language or tighten up the way he applied the policy. The arbitrator says here, Chaparney took great pains to hide his identity. His immediate chain of command, two sergeants and one lieutenant, didn't think he violated the policy. And he points to the fact that the IA investigation didn't mention the general public being aware of his posts or the fact that they were made by a police officer. Bottom line, the arbitrator says, the police monitor was, and I'm quoting, this arbitrator's really out there, was more right than she knew. Under the just cause standard of labor relations, the department's policy fails the crucial criteria of fair notice of just what the department prohibits. And because the policy wasn't written clearly enough, says the arbitrator, you can't use the policy to discipline Officer Chaparty, overturn the suspension, make him whole. This is not a published arbitrator's decision. You can get copies of it from LRIS. We'll post it. But it sure is making the rounds. And I think the arbitrator's somewhat out there language notwithstanding, I think the arbitrator's opinion is really fundamentally sound. One of the key requirements for employer policies, whether they're operational policies or disciplinary policies, is clarity. Somebody has to be able to look at that policy and know what's permitted and know what is prohibited. And if you can sit there and look at a policy and spin off within 30 seconds or a minute, four or five examples where people end up scratching their head and say, geez, I don't know, you got a problem policy. The second point the arbitrator's making that I think is a good one is don't just simply buy policies off the shelf if you're an employer. Don't uncritically put them into your manual, no matter where you're getting them from. This isn't a criticism on my part of Lexapol. There's lots of people who are offering these off-the-shelf policies, and I see public safety agencies uncritically adopting those policies. Stop it. You can use those as a base, but adapt them to your own needs, and in particular, adapt them after you have consulted with your own counsel as to whether or not these policies work in your state. The last case I want to talk about this month comes out of Michigan, and I want to use it not so much as an illustration of what the case holds, but as an example of the power that some states have given to what are called emergency financial managers, and also as an example of how we need to pay attention sometimes to seemingly non-controversial clauses in collective bargaining agreements. We need to be paying more attention to the language and exactly what words we are choosing to use. Okay, so let's start with the emergency manager piece. Michigan is one of a few states that have what I think of as an emergency financial manager law. And under this law, the governor can appoint an emergency manager to basically take control of a municipality or public school system. This is pursuant to something in Michigan that's known as the Local Financial Stability and Choice Act, but really I think everybody thinks of it as the emergency manager law. Emergency managers have a tremendous amount of authority under this statute. Those powers include the ability to nullify collective bargaining agreements, the ability to privatize public jobs, overrule minimum staffing requirements. Essentially, an emergency manager is a mayor, a city council, and a city manager all rolled up into one. In some places, city councils have simply stopped meeting because there's an emergency manager who was on the scene. Well, this is the story of Kathy Square. Square is the emergency manager for the city of Hamtramck. I am certainly going to mispronounce that. Hamtramck, Michigan. And she gets appointed by the governor. And the city is facing all sorts of budgetary problems. And one of the problems that Square quickly identifies is retiree medical is costing too much money. Retiree medical had been a feature of fire and police contracts for many, many years. It was a great plan, a wonderful plan. And Square ends up deciding we need to make it a little bit less generous. And so what she does is to end the plan covering deductibles for employees. The new plan is essentially the same as the other, only under the old plan, the plan covered deductibles. Under the new plan, retirees have to pay their own deductibles, and there's some different co-payments that are in place. A group of fire and police retirees sue the city, and they say that Square's actions violated their vested contract rights. So, what's that all about? Under the federal Constitution, and as well under many, maybe even all, I'm not sure, I don't know enough to say that, but certainly many state constitutions, there's a clause known as the Contracts Clause. And the Contracts Clause prevents government from interfering with an existing contract. And for many years, the contracts clauses in the state and federal constitutions have been applied when there have been attempts to cut back on retiree benefits, usually pensions. There's big debate in the law as to whether or not retiree medical benefits have the same contract clause standing as do pensions. But it's pretty clear that pensions themselves, at least for retirees and certainly for active employees to a lesser extent, I'm not going to get into that one right now, but at least for retirees, pensions are protected by the Contracts Clause. And most states would say retiree medical benefits are protected under the Contracts Clause, assuming, of course, that you had a contract that called for lifetime benefits. So what the police and fire retirees in the city are doing here is they're saying, look, we did have a contract. And under the contract, we agreed we would work our careers for you. And you agreed you'd provide deductible less retiree health care. And you are unilaterally, you, the city, through the emergency manager, you are unilaterally altering half of that bargain. You are saying now we have to pay the deductible, but you're not offering to pay us any more money. We've already given all of our service to you. We worked our work lives for you. You can't unilaterally change half of the benefit. And that goes to a federal court of appeals. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals has jurisdiction over Michigan. And the Sixth Circuit sides with Square and allows the benefit cuts. Now, here comes the second part of why I wanted to talk about this case. The first part is the enormous powers that emergency financial managers have. Nobody here disputes whether or not Square could actually put into effect these changes. The question is whether the changes are constitutional. But the notion that you have one human being, essentially without supervision anywhere, being able to change this benefit, that's an enormous amount of power. So that's the first thing I wanted to talk about. The second thing is this notion that we ought to be focusing on some of the more mundane clauses in our collective bargaining agreements, because the court's decision here turns on the duration clause of the contract. How long is the contract in effect? And the court says, look, we're only going to enforce this notion of a lifetime contract for deductible less health care benefits. We're only going to enforce it if we can find some clear indication in the collective bargaining agreement that this benefit was meant to continue for the rest of the lives of retirees. We want to see, and I'm borrowing from the court here, unambiguous writings that created lifetime promises. And you know what, says the court? We don't see them here. All we see is the usual durational clause in a collective bargaining agreement. The contract, if you look at the duration clause, says it expires on June 30, 2011. There's no exceptions to that. There's no exceptions that say that retiree medical benefits will continue unchanged for the rest of the life of retirees. We're not going to give any special status to the retiree medical clause in the collective bargaining agreement. We're going to treat it like any other provision of the contract, and it will expire whenever the rest of the contract expires. And the court says the only reasonable inference that we can reach from looking at this duration clause is that there's no vested right to lifetime health care benefits, and thus the parties have to renew them every time they're negotiating a new contract. Well, this is no doubt the triumph, the absolute triumph, form over substance, right? I have no doubt that the city and the various unions, the IAFF, and I think it's the FOP there, I have no doubt that when they negotiated lifetime medical benefits, they were convinced that they meant lifetime medical benefits without deductibles, that neither of them, or none of them, ever dreamed that someone who had put in their 25 years of service and retired, you know, when they were 78 years old or however old they were, all of a sudden could have their benefits unilaterally reduced by the city. I don't doubt what the bargain was here. I'd be shocked if it was anything other than that. The problem is they didn't put that bargain into the collective bargaining agreement. They didn't write their duration clause of the contract, or they could have put this in the retiree medical section, saying that if the contract expires, retiree medical benefits will be continued until a new contract is negotiated. They didn't say that. And so, a reminder. Focus on these, you know, various and sundry miscellaneous clauses that are usually stacked at the end of a collective bargaining agreement. Look at your savings clause. Look at your complete agreement clause. Look at your durations clause. All of these clauses, and make sure that they are capturing exactly what it is you want to do with your collective bargaining agreement. Because if you don't, you may end up with the same form over substance decision from a court. Well, thank you for listening to a bit of a longer than normal podcast. I didn't get to three of the cases that I wanted to talk about because this fair share thing just happened, and it really, I think, is the most important thing to come along in years. So we'll probably have a case law packed first Thursday when I record the one in November. And we hope to see you at an upcoming LRIS seminar. We've got one in November in Las Vegas on the use of force. We're just coming off of what I think of was a wonderfully successful seminar on grievances and arbitration, where we had some great speakers. Hope to see you at an upcoming seminar. And stay safe. This is Will Aitchison signing off.